It's a really interesting story. It comes just after. Remember, John's always got a plan. He structures this thing. And so it's always good to kind of think about where it is in the context of what he's trying to communicate. The chapter before, the last chapter, the end of chapter 4, John tells the story of Jesus healing a man's servant. And it says, a man sought Jesus out. And when he found Jesus, he said, come, my servant is sick. Come and heal him. And then Jesus says, go, you'll be fine. Well, son, sorry, he'll be fine. And he believes and leaves. Trust of the word. And then the servants come and meet him afterwards and say, hang on a minute, it's all happened. When did it happen? Exactly at the hour Jesus said those words. And so you've got this story before of somebody going to find Jesus for healing, Jesus speaking a word, and the person trusting that word, and then going back, not knowing if it's happened or not, but trusting in the word that had been spoken, and then on the way finds out that at the exact moment those words would be another immediately, right? Those exact words at those moments, the moment those words were spoken, that person had become well. And so this first story, at the end of chapter 4, is somebody who knows Jesus, has heard that he can heal, goes to find him, and puts trust in the word that is spoken, and later finds out that the healing took place at exactly the right time. In this story, we've got somebody who knows nothing about Jesus, has got no idea who he is, who, when Jesus asks, would you like to be made well, goes to, well, nobody's here to help me. And then when Jesus says the word, pick up your mat and walk, and he becomes well, he's still got no idea who the guy is. And he's gone. And people challenge, like, what the heck happened? He's like, I don't know, I can walk. Like, why are you carrying your mat? You're not supposed to do that on the Sabbath. Well, the guy who healed me told me to do it. Who's that? I don't know. Now, this isn't the way it's supposed to happen, right? Because we all know that if you want healing and miracles, you have to hold a prayer meeting. That's the way it's supposed to work. Or you have to at least know who Jesus is, go to him, wait for him to say something, and then put faith in his word, knowing it will happen. Because that's the way it's supposed to work. And what's interesting, and this is one of the cunning plans I think John has in the way he structures and writes his thing, his words, is that he's basically trying to communicate, I haven't got this guy figured out yet. I don't know how this happened. I don't know how this works. Now, I'm comforted by that because I've held kids as they've died in my arms. And I haven't got it figured out. Because I'm in those moments and I'm praying because this ain't right. This is not fair. This is not okay. This is not just, this is not. Where is the mercy, right? So, and I can traumatize myself by going to some of those memories. Don't, Gareth. I haven't got it figured out. Like, if you came to me and you said to me, well, the Bible says that you have, if somebody's sick among you, you have to call the elders, get the anointing oil, and pray for them, and they will be made well. We could have a list of this is the process on the wall. And that's how you get it done. And John, in the way he's writing this stuff, is saying, I haven't got this figured out. All I know is the guy. I don't know the why. I don't know the how. I don't know the when. And I don't know the what. That's unsettling for those of us that like to be in control. Go back to this story. I grew up in church. Those of you that know me know I grew up in church. But that doesn't mean that I'm some sort of wanky Christian that doesn't have a naughty streak. So when I was in a church in Ilford, many, many years ago when I was a young person, I remember them having a baptismal pool. in the middle. And they used to have baptismal services, and they used to put fake grass around the baptismal. I don't know why. It's just more spiritual. And so we put this fake, and it wasn't even the good fake grass, it was the kind of strange plasticky stuff that looks old very quickly, right? And they put it all around, and they used to get drawing pins and pen it into the wood, putting it all around, so you'd have this nice grass scene with the waters. Maybe they wanted it to make it look more like the Jordan or something like that, but really, if you want to go Jordan authentic, there should be other things floating in it. And so, the grass around it and everything else. And so what we used to do is the kids, my age, would have been about six, seven, something like that. We were all invited round to watch, and we could peer over into the water, put your hands in, as people were being baptized. So we were in the splash zone at Disneyland, and around the pool. And so what we would do is we would pull out the drawing pins and flip them into the water. And so there would be this elder that came along, and he had a genius idea. He had a broom handle, and he would go along and he would kind of get them so they were pinned straight up, and then just dip the broom handle into it, pull them out, and he would kind of save the day from the rebellious children who were trying to find very amusing moments of seeing if somebody could suddenly get filled with the Holy Spirit in the middle of the baptismal pool, because they suddenly started leaping around. And everybody else would be thinking God was moving and stirring the waters, and actually what was happening is the drawing pins were in there. And I noticed then, and this is where my mischievous mind is, I noticed when John writes this, that he says there were blind people around the pool when the water stirred. So have you ever, those bathrooms where there's the lights on the outside of the bathroom? I'm just going to confess now, right? If I'd been living in Jerusalem at the time of Pool of Bethesda, and there were people around there, as a kid, I would have walked up and I would have done this. Like that. And what would have happened is there would have been a whole bunch of people diving in. You couldn't see that some idiot was stirring the waters themselves. And so they would, can you imagine how you could play with this? You could have a, nobody would do a thing like that, right? Nobody is that mischievous in this world. I get it from my dad and my mother, actually, but her mother rather than her. You've got this pool of water, a whole bunch of people that are sick. It's a bit like Lourdes, right? They've all gone to this place for their healing. And families would have brought people there. They would be laying them down if they were paralyzed. If they were blind, there may have been somebody there trying to help guide them to the water, unless they're trying to follow the sound and stumble their way in. And you can imagine the moment where, the reason verse 4 is in there is because we believe, it's not in the earliest manuscripts, we believe that somebody probably added it in to try and provide some context, but a number of your Bibles won't put verse 4 in there because technically it wasn't in the original. So sometimes it's bracketed, sometimes it's not. But if you take it out, it still has the stirring of the waters and people moving in, so it doesn't take away from the context of the story. But that's why the verse 4 is in there. So you can imagine the scenario of these waters ruffling, people climbing over each other to try and get in the water. Why? Because this is your chance. Yeah, you're in Jerusalem, city of peace. You're in the near the temple where God is. Yeah, you're in the place of mercy. You're in that space. This is your shot. This guy's been sat there for 38 years. 38 years. I was 9 38 years ago. And he's still there. That is a long time, sitting in one place, hoping to be first into the stirred waters. Mm-hmm. If you're not first, you're not getting it. What? That doesn't seem fair. The fastest off the line wins. And here's this guy, he's been 38 years, right? Go back to the kids that mess around, right? You can't sit next to people for 38 years without knowing their name. Nobody's helping him in. There's one of two things. In my head, there's two possibilities there. Either everybody is so flipping selfish that nobody's willing to let him get in there first because they've just watched 20 people go in front of him over the last 5 years or something like that. Or he's wrong to be around and nobody wants to help him. It's probably a combination of both. Because you'll have a mix of people in that place. And he says to Jesus, when Jesus says, do you want to be well? Not, yep. Let's help me in. Okay. He says, nobody is here to help me. Nobody loves me. Everybody hates me. Look at my life. Look at how horrendous my life is. Look at the train wreck because of my story. And all I've got to hope for is to sit here and maybe get the first of these words, that maybe I get lucky next. It's all about luck. It's all about who gets in first. It's all about my life is much more pitiful than somebody else's because they got in first because they got somebody to help them up and I don't have anyone to help me. And now I think John's trying to connect something to something that goes on in the human heart, which is, it's all right for them over there, but look at what God dealt me. Look at what I have to deal with. Look at my life. And he has had 38 years of this. And it isn't that he has been by the pool, not getting healed for 38 years. It's that 38 years by the pool not getting healed has got into him. So even when somebody comes by and asks him the obvious question, do you want to get well? All he can think about is how he never gets any help. Nobody will help me. And it's a difficult space to be in your heart when you feel that life has betrayed you, or even that God has betrayed you. Like, I remember when I was working in hospitals, I was 24. And I won't tell the story, but a mother of a guy who was my age confronted me in the middle of the corridor because I couldn't save this guy's life. And we were kind of halfway between two bays. So there were six people there in beds, six people there in beds, and it's kind of the gap between the two. It's probably the sink and stuff, and the waste bin and stuff on the side. And she came up to me right in the middle of the corridor, right in the busy evening shift, it was about 6 o'clock. So food's being served and all sorts of things. And she just starts screaming at me for what a favorite. I'm 24 years old now. I'm like a year and a half into medicine. I've just worked 5 years in medical school. And here I am doing my very best, knowing full well I'm not good enough. Like, I've got colleagues, but they're all telling me we can't do anything. And she just screams at me for half an hour. In the middle of the busy corridor, in the middle of the busy ward, with people walking past thinking, what the hell did that doctor do that she's going to scream at him for that? And I thought, zoom out of your own kind of where you are moment in my head. And I thought, I've got two choices here. I can walk away from her or react or something, or I can just stand here and take this. So I just stood there and took it. To this day, I probably don't know whether it was the right idea, but I think it was. And that's where a lot of your memories end up sitting sometimes. You're never quite sure whether you did the right thing, you just sort of think you did. And what was going on in my head is, I'd rather you let this out of me than you let this out of people that are really going to get hurt by what you say. Because at least, you know, we're not related. But at least I don't have to do Christmas dinner with you. Right? Because I've seen smashed up families because of that stuff. So I'm like, wait, go on, lay it out. Like, I'll just absorb this. Never forget it, right? But I'll take that. If this is healing to you, then you lay that out. If this is you need right now, then I'll take that. Because I want you to be okay, even if he's not going to be okay. That's 38 years in this guy's soul. 38 years of pain, of seeing others go first, of people walking away. Somebody brought him there to begin with, right? So he had to have somebody. And maybe they lasted 5 years. Maybe they lasted 1 week. I don't know. But at some point, everybody's gone. And this guy is sad. Now, he doesn't know Jesus. He doesn't know who this guy is. He doesn't know he's God. He doesn't know he's a prophet. He doesn't know he's anything, right? And Jesus is just walking by, and it says in these verses, there's a multitude there. So there's a whole bunch of people Jesus didn't hear. Let's just lay that one right there. There was one water that we know was stirred, and that was one person, right? And he just says something probably as he's walking past, because the guy didn't even get a chance to turn around and ask him his name. And as he's walking past, you want to be well. There's nobody to help you get up and walk. Get up and walk. Immediately he's strengthened, gets up and walks, picks up his bed, by the time he turns around, he dies. Jesus isn't supposed to do it like that. Like if you were running Jesus' PR campaign, you would turn around to Jesus at this point and you would say to him, what you need to do now is stick this on a TikTok video. And post this on your Twitter feed, like rise and walk. Like before and after shot. That's going in the book. You know, and then you market that campaign so that others can know, so everybody can know how you do it. But he just walks off. And I go back to John's first thoughts about the book of John, like, I haven't got this figured out. Like, my wisdom wouldn't do that. I wouldn't have done it any of the ways that they said to do it. He's done it here. That would not be the way I'd show up. Even if I was, like, full of faith, like, full of power, like, to just decide who got healed, and I was to wander in with my pride, now with my gifting, two are not the same, right? How often are they in our lives, right? So with my gifting, God will humble us all, right? So I was walking with my gifting, I would be like, if I had John with me or Peter, I'd be like, Peter, John, you know these guys. Who's the sickest? Which is the worst case? Like who's 3 minutes from death? And they'd be like, I don't know. And if the myth and the rumor was that the angel stirs the waters, and the first person in gets healed. What I would have done if I was God is I would have walked along and I'd have gone like this with my hand. And I'd have watched everybody die there. And if I had the choice, every single person would have got healed. And then I'd walked out of that place and there's not a multitude of sick people there, they're all sorted out. That's what I would have going over my head. I can't figure out why God didn't do that. That's what I would have done. But he didn't. And I have to get to a point in my head, like I've had to get to a point with the amount of suffering I've seen, where I've decided, I don't know how, I don't know why, I don't know what, but he knows best. Because otherwise, 38 years is going to get into me. You read a little later on that Jesus meets him again. And he says, oh, I see you, you know, you're walking around doing well at the temple. And the guy's like, oh, finally, like, who are you? Like, I'm Jesus. Okay, great. And then he goes back to the guys and says, Jesus that healed me. Like, get him. don't criticize me for kind of carrying my bed on the Sabbath. It's his fault, right? So you don't even get this sense of, you're amazing, you're awesome, I can't believe it, like, you healed me. Else, why? Because there's still something going on in his soul. There's still something going on that needs sorting out. Jesus speaks to him and he says, go and sin no more. And Bear in mind, he's carrying his bed on the Sabbath, which the Pharisees would say was a sin. And Jesus says, go and sin no more, and he's the guy that told him to carry the bed. So now go figure out what sin means. And I think what it means in this context, and this is the best I can come up with, and I've read a few commentaries, I think what sin means in this context is go and figure out what it means to live a holy life with God. Go and figure out what it means to live full of God, not full of 38 years. Like, this is your new start line. Like, when the waters were stirred, when the firing gun goes off, and now you can pick up your bed and walk, new life begins now. All things have passed away, all things are becoming new. I can't understand why it was 38 years. But what I do know is there's life in these limbs, there's breath in these lungs, and there's a world that needs the heart of God. So this moment that's going on in this healing, Jesus is doing something profound, and John is trying to teach us something. Who had faith? Nobody. He didn't heal because of the guy's faith. Which means it's not about charging up the dynamo of faith through religious worship to get to the point where there's the sparkling and the dunamis of the spirit in the light fittings of the church. So that you can get so charged up that you can command this thing in faith. Great though that is, and there are some verses that might help you support that view. But John is saying, I can't figure this one out. Because this guy didn't even know who he was. How can you possibly have faith in Jesus in this story if you don't even know who he is? And your eyes are on stirred waters, not on the presence of God. And so often as Christians, bless us, in our desire to get things sorted out, we get our eyes on the method. And we get stuck on, we did everything right, and it still not happened. As if God, sadly, is the cosmic vending machine in which we put the right amount into the slot, press the button for our answer, and out comes the Coca-Cola, right? Trust me, I wish, in part of me wishes it worked that way, because it'd be an awful lot easier. Like, pastoring would be HTS. There's the list. Right, so we would have a line coming through the door. You need salvation, you need to go down that line. You need a miracle, just give up this line, just follow the list. You need forgiveness, you need to come down this line, this is the way you kneel, you have to kneel from that point there. Just come kneeling. You press, okay, come into the joy line, you have to start dancing and clapping from the third step in, and by the time you expect weeping and joy all the way at this front here, and this is where you have, I'm sorry, I've not figured out. He's God, I'm not. Now there's clues. We read scriptures, there's clues, there's principles and everything else, but at the end of the day, God is not a series of principles, a series of reasoned arguments, or a series of practical statements. God is a person, not a process. And our faith is therefore not in the process, but in the person. And what's interesting about Jesus' comments is he says, go sin no more, so that something worse will happen to you. So something worse wouldn't happen to him. That was worse than that. So often we have our eyes, this is the only chink in the I think I found a reason. other than it's his glory, it's his person, it's his manifest, it's who he is, right? Other than that, there's something worse that would happen if it happened. So then you start thinking, like all those things I saw, 38 years, it would have been worse if it hadn't. Like somewhere in the negative that happens in our lives is the goodness of God. Like somewhere in there, God is actually doing something in me. Like somewhere in the moment when I'm holding the child, as we are doing CPR on them, God is working. We're probably going to finish early because I want to finish on this. Those last verses I read, I'm supposed to preach to 15, but I had to get 17 in, so Mark's going to have to forgive me next week. This isn't just about the healing. This is about God at rest, the Sabbath. And the story is that you're not supposed to do anything on the Sabbath. The Pharisees had come up with, I think it was like 1,000 rules. I think it was 1,500 and something rules. Malcolm will be able to tell you exactly the number. And the rules were, you could, on the Sabbath, work meant anything that you did which was beyond basic survival. That's pretty much it. That's 1,500 rules condensed down into that. So work was more than anything more than the lifting of the spoon to the mouth to feed yourself. So you couldn't carry your bed on the Sabbath. So Jesus is commanding this guy break the Sabbath according to the interpretation of the Pharisees. We see it in other chapters, we see it in other healings and miracles. Like, how do you heal somebody on the Sabbath? Like, and Jesus turns around and says, well, you know, if you have an ox that fell into the ditch, would you not help it out on the Sabbath? No, we'd wait for it until the next day. Now we can help the ox, poor thing. No, you'd help the ox, right? So why can't we heal a person? So Jesus is kind of challenging these things because the Sabbath is when God rests. Because it's all set up from the first 7 days of creation. On the seventh day, God rested, and it taught mankind that 6 days you will work. 6 days? I don't have 6 days. 6 days you will work, and on the next day you'll rest. The fun thing about the Sabbath is that the old rabbinical tradition was that they said the Jews fell in love with the day. I probably talked to you a little bit about the Sabbath before, but you're just going to hear it again. So it's a great book by Abraham Heschel called The Sabbath, and it's like reading pure poetry parts of it. And he says that we have a concept in our framework of sacred spaces, and I kind of laid waste to some of that when I talked to you about Jesus in the temple. But we have this idea of sacred spaces. And Heschel says, he's Jewish, so he's not a Christian, but he talks about the Jewish tradition of the Sabbath, was that that this teaches us, this idea teaches us about the sacredness of place. Like Moses taking his shoes off, this ground is holy, that there's sacred spaces. So sacred spaces in the household are often the ensuite bathroom in the parents' bedroom. If you've got one, so the kids aren't allowed to go in there, well, that's my toilet and somebody else can use the other ones because this one's nice and clean and this is the one I like to sit on. Those are sacred spaces. Sacred space would be the kitchen drawer that nobody can go in because that's where the nice knives are or something like that. I don't know. Anyway, so sacred spaces. You've got these other sacred spaces. Heschel says that the Sabbath teaches us that time is sacred. Sacredness of time. And they used to, the old rabbis used to teach that the purpose of the Sabbath was for you to remind yourself that time with family, time with friends, this is the purpose of life. Like you weren't made to work, that work serves the family. And so you would have not worked on that day because you were supposed to play. You were supposed to enjoy the day. The fruits of your labor were to be enjoyed for an entire day. And so that was the tradition built up into a religious practice with what we define, what is work? What do we mean by work? Right? Which, well, you know, is that work or is that, you know, is packing to go on holiday the next day work? Should I pack the previous day so that I can not be doing anything on the Sabbath, so that we can go on holiday on the Sunday, right? So you get the idea of this idea. And the Sabbath is the sacredness of time. And yet, in this story, this guy's got 38 years. And for him, that time isn't sacred, right? And a lot of that would have been, where the heck are you? Like, are you on holiday? Like, if you'd only been here. We hear those words related later on in John 11 when they turn around to Jesus and he's on his way to Lazarus and Lazarus has died. And they say, if you'd only been here, Jesus, he would still be alive. Like, God's on holiday. And yet, the final verse in this section, verse 17, Jesus turns around to these guys and he says, my Father is always working, and I am always working. And what he does, if you put faith in those words, not faith in your understanding, for just one moment, and I'm not the biggest fan of that, by the way. I don't think God invites us to let our mind fall out as we walk through the doors of buildings like this. Or we listen to what we listen to on YouTube or whatever it may be. I don't think the call of God upon our lives is to not understand. I think the call of God on our lives is not to depend fully on our understanding when it comes to Him. If, and I recognize because I've done this, how challenging this is, but it's the only way I know to walk through some of the most difficult situations in your lives and the things you have faced and the things you will face, and to process them without losing Jesus in the middle of it, is to look for the goodness of God in the darkest times. And sometimes I recognize how hard this is to thank God for them. Not because they're good, but in thanking Him, you find Him in them. Remember, it would be about this time. 5 years ago, been here 5 years. I had a season where I had no church, I had no job. And circumstances had meant that I had to get out of the one I was in. Not because of anything I've done, but because to remain would have caused division. And so it would have been about the Christmas time, 5.5 years ago. And as somebody that's a doctor, that has postgrads in ethics and law, that has an ordination, and has had some crazy experiences in the power of moving the spirit, as well as some great challenges, to find myself dropping my kids off at school, driving back to a barn where somebody was letting us live there for free because we had no income. And I'm due a phone call by AM headquarters to talk about station, new church availability. And to have that phone call on the way back where they basically say there's nothing for you. And the Eden conference, which was just being at, was coming up. And they said, don't bother talking to anyone, Gareth, because there's nothing for you there. This is the leaders of Eden telling me nobody's going to help me get in order. And I put my hand on the door handle to go into a barn where I've got my family. School rules of work, but I've got nothing. Like male pride, right? Put my hand on the door handle of the barn. And God said, put your hope in Eden, did you? Yeah, but you had your eyes on the still water, did you, Gareth? Yeah. So So I went inside. And then he said, if I ever use you again, would you be all right with that? I'd been processing through that time, looking for the goodness of God. And I look back on that season. There was a moment when God's provision was astounding. And I look back on that season. And the challenge that season during that time, because there were some really difficult times in the run-up to when I had to move away. And I can see what he was doing. See what he was doing in me. I would see what he was doing in my vision. I can see what he was grooving into me by putting words into my soul during the toughest cutting of the inside of my being. Put your open needle, did you? If I've never used your needle, you'd be all right with that. Which now breathes so much life into me. Because Ian didn't let me down. I should have never had my hope in there in the first place. Like, my hope should not be in the power of men, or the decisions of men, or the opportunities laid out by men. My hope should be in what God has ordained for my life. Good or ill, that's where my hope will be. And if he never used me again, I'd be okay with that. There'd be a bit of me that would look on from the sides, cheer others on and wish. A bit like most of us that are past it from playing football still wish we could play for our teams, right? But I was far longer than I planned, but the band are going to be invited up in about 2 minutes. But those will never be gone out of me. Because that terrible situation created a groove through my life. And when I opened myself up to God and to his words and allowed him to speak into my soul in the midst of that deep cutting, he put seeds in there that are bearing fruit now in my life and don't cause me to step into elements of pride thinking about my own gifting and the place I am right now. Because he could choose tomorrow to never use me again and I'd be okay with that. That's what he does. And that glimmer of reasoning that I could connect with in that he is working. He was working then. I don't know how. I don't know how painful that must sound to you, but you've got to work through that. Because trust me, you get to the other end of that, holding on to the coattails of Jesus for bare life sometimes, because that's what it feels like. He will have done things in you that will bless thousands of people. That's what he's at work doing. We don't hear any more about this guy's story. John wrote it down, and here we are telling it. And the strapline at the end is that he is working always, even in the darkest moments, even over the legacy of 38 years. And he is working now, both the Father and the Son and the Spirit. Let's pray. Father, I thank you for the wonderful opportunity to reflect, to remember, to dig deep at the mercy house of God. We thank you, Lord, as we enter through the gate which reminds us of your sacrifice and everything you went through for us, as we meet you in the house of mercy, where we are reminded of your grace and your goodness to us. And as we take our eyes off what we know and remind ourselves of your goodness and that you are at work at all times, even when we turn around and say to you, you're on holiday. That you don't take a day off in our lives, Lord, no matter how dark they can. And that, Lord, help us, Lord, help our faith. Help our hearts. Speak into our lives that we might have your words as anchors to our soul, driven deep into the places of our lives, so that we will know as we step from where we are into the season of the next 38 years, we will know a new heart and a new spirit and a new way to live. But wherever we find ourselves, whatever place we are around this pool, Lord, I ask you to stir the waters of our hearts and that you would do a work in us that would not only transform our lives, but would transform the lives of so many around us who don't.